Welcome to SCI Science Perspectives, a podcast brought to you by the American Spinal Injury Association. In this podcast, we'll be discussing emerging literature spanning the full spectrum of SCI research, from discovery to clinical application. You're listening to an administrative episode with Matthew Reuterich. I'm David.
And I'm Marla, and today we'll be discussing the organization titled Unite to Fight Paralysis. Our guest today is Matthew Reuterich, Unite to Fight Paralysis's Executive Director. Matthew of Minneapolis, Minnesota, entered the SCI community after his son Gabriel sustained a C5 injury while body surfing in Costa Rica. After leaving his position as Emergency Department Operations Supervisor for the Fairview Health System, he and Gabriel traveled the world in search of the best therapeutic options, only to end up back in Minnesota advocating for cure research. Matthew led a coalition of Minnesota SCI community advocates and researchers to leverage the state legislature in pursuit of public funding for SCI research. In 2012, he made a short documentary film featuring then Minnesota Viking punter and Twitter celebrity Chris Clue, spending a day in a wheelchair. The screening of Chris Clue Rolls a Mile in Someone Else's Wheels kicked off their 2013 legislative campaign. The bill was passed in 2015 as the MNSCI TBI Research Grant Program, helping to inspire and launch U2FP's Cure Advocacy Network. U2FP's CAN has passed similar legislation in Washington, Pennsylvania, and Ohio, and is now working with advocates and scientists in Wisconsin to pass a $3 million SCI research grant bill. Matthew credits U2FP and their annual symposium with providing the knowledge, focus, and energy to see the real possibility of an end to the debilitating effects of paralysis. Welcome, Matthew.
Hey there. How you doing?
Great. We're really excited to have you and learn a little bit more about everything that your organization kind of stands for. I wonder if you could just go a little bit into the origin and overview of what you guys do.
Sure. The genesis of the organization came from a group of women who were in support of helping to pass the Christopher and Dana Reeve Paralysis Act in D.C. and participated in a rally, which I think was pretty notable. I think Hillary Clinton was there and Susan Sarandon, you know, friends of Christopher Reeve after his death. And it was in that rally where these women, some who had spinal cord injury and some who were mothers of kids with spinal cord injuries, kind of realized that if we're going to be effective advocates in this space, none of us really understand the science. And we have to kind of familiarize ourselves with what's happening in the research, what's realistic, what's reasonable to expect from the scientific system. And the idea of creating a meeting, an annual meeting focused on and curated by the SCI community, these women, launched the first annual, what was called Working to Walk Annual Symposium, Science and Advocacy Symposium, back in 2005 or six, I think. Maybe I think six was the first, because I think 05 was the rally. So they formed the nonprofit really based around this annual symposium. And that was essentially the organization at that time, trying to figure out how to organize the community, familiarize and contextualize the science from a layperson's perspective, from an advocate perspective, so that they could be more effective. I mean, from there, I guess I could keep going and just say up to my introduction to the organization, which came in 2010, a couple of years after my son's injury. They had evolved to the point where they'd created a scientific advisory board. They had a marathon team raising money, and they were growing in their sort of maturing in their advocacy efforts. But when I intersected with them, they were really asking this fundamental question. When people come to our meeting, particularly people with spinal cord injuries or from the community, people like me, parents, flex folk, when they come to our meeting, what do we do with them? If they want to do something, what do we do? They've sat for 2 days and listened to scientists. You know, back then it was people like Hans Kierstad and Wise Young and Jerry Silver and I can't even remember Oswald Stewart and you know people that were prominent back in that period of time. And when they were, you know, sort of my predecessor used to call it drinking from the garden hose full on. After a couple of days, what do you do? What do you tell them to do when they go home? And that's when I came along, hit that meeting and thought, you know, I'm not somebody who's wealthy. I don't have celebrity, but I want to do something about my son's injury. And the first thing I thought of was I heard someone talk about this group called Cures, something Cures, Patricia Morton, and a whole bunch of other folks mostly passed bills on the East Coast in the 90s. And they stopped with the election of George W. Bush because back then stem cells were kind of, you know, it, the promise. And when George W. Bush came in and put that moratorium on stem cell lines, they kind of backed away from some of their efforts, but they had passed, I think, 8, 9, 10 bills, including the Roman Reed Act on the West Coast, Florida, Kentucky, New York, Massachusetts, you know, a bunch of states. But then they stopped and nothing really happened after that. And I came along, went to the meeting, was very inspired, moved, educated, went back home. And as you read in my bio, went to the legislature, got kicked around for a few years, cut my teeth, got crushed, and then eventually kind of learned how to do that, what to do, and ended up passing a bill. And that kind of put me back into the organization's dashboard and eventually got hired, eventually took over in 2017.
We're really glad that you went and blazed that trail. And I think technically a larva, when it's going through the chrysalis phase, metabolizes its central nervous system before becoming a butterfly. So you were crushed.
Yeah, torn apart. Yep, for sure.
And so if we can stick just on the meeting here as the kind of origin of U2FP, there is a clear what can I do? And we'll finish the episode discussing a little bit more of that. But for now, with the meeting, has the meeting itself evolved? I mean, there's a lot of players in the meeting now,
Yeah.
multi-stakeholder, even artists. Can you talk a little about the meeting evolution?
Yeah, so I think initially, you know, and I'm sort of this a little bit of conjecture. Obviously, I wasn't there. I came to the organization, you know, some 6, 7 years after it started, five or a little less. I think it was really explicitly focused on gathering the community, educating the community, and starting to cultivate a relationship with the scientists, with researchers specifically. Over time, that question emerged of, well, what do we do with people? How do we support them when they come to our meeting? They get, you know, all this information thrown at them. What do we do with them? And that became a real challenge for the organization to consider. What emerged was, okay, well, how can we support people once they come to this meeting? And so there was a lot of discussion around that when I came to the organization and, you know, pursued this legislative thing. And started to answer that question. And then we launched, you know, shortly after launched our own podcast and a whole array of initiatives. But what started to mature or evolve was this notion of like, yeah, we need to educate our community about the science. But along the way, you started to realize, oh, well, we also need to educate the scientists about the lived experience. And then, oh, yeah, clinicians see people from the community, but they see them in a very structured, institutional, hierarchical way. They also need to be educated about the lived experience. Other stakeholders, funders, public agencies, industry itself, companies need to be educated about the lived experience. And that started to kind of bleed into the meeting and shift a little bit of the focus. And then as it's matured, I think growing that perspective that the community is a player here, you know, the end user ultimately of whatever comes out of the system. So they need to be savvy. You know, they need to take ownership of a sort of knowledge responsibility. But then also the other stakeholders need to take ownership of that. You know, these are the people that are going to use whatever we discover. These are the people that we're trying to understand, you know, the pathophysiology of spinal cord injury and what to do with it. So we should probably talk with them. Like we should have a better understanding from their perspective without assumption. And so I think that was the big shift in the organization right about the time that I came along, where we created the podcast and, you know, our Cure Advocacy Network was growing. We started passing bills. Our advocates in each state were getting savvier. We were placing them on advisory boards along with scientists and clinicians to prioritize research for appropriation of dollars. And then we started asking the question, well, what do we do with them once they're there? Like, well, how do we support our community once they're there? How do we support the research and clinical community once they're kind of we've had this collision of perspectives. And then we kicked off our Lab Rats initiative, which is this notion of like, we're going to place or offer to place people with lived experience into a lab, whether virtually or physically, on the regular. So, and we have people working on projects. We have people working in the lab, virtually meeting in a lab meeting every week or once a month or once a quarter or more than one person advising and consulting on projects. And now we have a direct kind of line. We're now operating in, I think, 20 labs with 25 people with spinal cord injuries, and it's growing. We have probably a stable of 40 or so, but about 25 that are placed. So that's kind of the, you know, high level growth of the community, trying to ready the community, which we continue to do, try to engage, pull people in, people who want to become involved, want to take action, not just sort of sit back and wait, read the headlines, tell me when a cure is coming, or tell me when a novel treatment is materialized. Our belief is that we have to make it happen. It's not gonna, it needs us. It needs a catalyst, for this system to be more efficient and more directed into our priorities.
Yeah, with this evolution going from that kind of unidirectional from the scientists to the advocates to this multidirectional between all the stakeholders, that's beautiful. And a plug for U2FP's CureCast, two episodes called Lab Rats,
Okay.
on the last initiative there, Matt, that you were just discussing. But from Asia's perspective, this being Asia's podcast, for those scientists, have there been any previous collaborations or any proposals you have for the future to get U2FP to interact with this professional membership?
Yeah, actually, I mean that my invitation to the podcast might be as a result of I reached out to the outreach committee at Asia and had a meeting with them a few months ago at the recommendation of a couple of Asia, well, actually a couple of past Asia presidents who have been to our meeting, a couple of whom have attended without presenting, which is a growing, or, you know, we have scientists that are showing up to our meeting that aren't on the agenda, which didn't used to happen. It happens with more frequency now. And it was a very early preliminary meeting, like, hey, I hear that you all would like to have a better relationship with the lived experience community. And the meetings that I've attended, there aren't many. And it's a, you know, obviously a very different kind of meeting than ours, as I've described. But there's an openness to that. What could we do? What could we explore? I've presented at the Asia meeting several times over the last years, and this last one in Puerto Rico, I was there giving a presentation on this Lab Rats initiative, along with Murray Blackmore and Lana Zoladeva, from each of their perspectives. And Jason Biondo, also, who's a PhD candidate at Harvard with a spinal cord injury. And it's really at this point, I don't really know where that's going to go. I think we have a skill set from running this meeting for the last 20 years that would be helpful to Asia to bring to the table. That's certainly one thing I mentioned. Not sure what that would look like, but I think we could help in a number of the ways, you know, anything from the logistics of doing a meeting and having, you know, 40 wheelchairs attending, and what those needs represent to how to craft certain elements of the agenda to make them accessible. We have had some past collaboration, particularly with Patty Duncan, where we reciprocate on trip sessions. So we've had someone who's on the agenda for Asia in a trip session come and present. And then we have some reciprocity where I get to go to the meeting, or some of my staff get to go to the meeting without registration fees, and those folks get covered for presenting at our meeting. We've done that sort of thing. But past that, it's kind of an open question. So if anyone listening has ideas, love to hear them. You could email me and we'll chat.
Well, if I had to, imagine in the moment, a lot of Asia's membership, maybe professors at universities, not all, obviously, but those ones who are probably good at writing federal grants and asking the federal government for money. But we might not be so good at asking state representatives for money. So can you talk a little bit here, Matt, about U2FP's history with this funding initiative that a lot of us probably need to familiarize ourselves a little more with?
Sure. So as I mentioned, we've passed bills in four states, and fingers crossed, knock on wood, soon to pass in a fifth state, in Wisconsin. They vary. They're all pretty much modeled the same way. The requests that we make, and the three of them are ongoing. Washington is no longer funded. It was essentially kind of a one-off for the University of Washington, but we're now approaching almost $40 million in dollars directed to research. Thank you. And hopefully with Wisconsin, which we're asking $5 million, $6 million in Minnesota, $3 million in Ohio, $2 million in Pennsylvania. They're all modeled very much the same way. We use the Minnesota language as our kind of template. And we also had initiatives in Texas and Colorado, but we're kind of moving away from them. Really four things. One is that we propose a competitive research grant process open to anyone in the state doing research, public or private. We do want to incentivize private companies, and we have some track record of doing that. Second is kind of targeted language, without being too targeted, but research that's pursuant of functional restoration. And third, a cap on indirect costs, which is something the legislators really like when they realize that some of the big institutions have 60% indirect cost rates. They're not thrilled with that because they already have, some of them have kind of contentious relationships with the big land grant public universities. And then lastly, that we create an advisory council made up of experts in the field and people with lived experience. And it really works. It historically has worked for us in two ways on both sides of the, political ideological construct. On the one side, conservative legislators, particularly fiscally conservative, like the idea that we are saying we don't want money wasted. We want money directed where it should go, and we want the people who have the most at stake to be at the table to decide how it gets used. That attracts them, and as well as the low indirect costs. It also attracts them when you start sharing with them something they don't know, which is that the cost that's associated with caring for people with spinal cord injury is insane, as you all know. We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars in a state budget. And then when you compare that with the current appropriation from the public coffers, we're looking at approximately $145 to $150 million a year. It's dwarfed by one state alone is spending maybe double that to care for people with spinal cord injury. So 50 states to spread $150 million, there's a profound disparity, and they like that. Progressives or Democrats, sort of left-leaning, like the idea that the people closest to the problem are currently generally not at the table to craft solutions. And that's a kind of, that's a ideological attractive position to say from a legislator point of view, and which is our point of view. We believe that we want to create space for our community to be at the table and voice its opinion on how money is being spent in research and to what end. And so that really works well at the legislature. But beyond that, it's really, I mean, everything I just said also has to be understood that all of that information and data, we provide a lot of data to legislators. We do a fair amount of background work, and now we've gotten pretty good at it. You have to put that data in a box, and that box is the story. The metaphor I often use with our advocates is like you need to get a treasure ch you need to get a treasure across the river, and you can try to put all the gold chains and diamond rings and swim across the river. But actually, what you need is a boat. Put the treasure chest in the boat and bring it across. The boat is the story. The boat is how you carry the data across, convey that to whoever you're talking to. And so our folks learn pretty quickly, actually. A lot of people are intimidated, but eventually they realize, oh, I can tell my story. And these people, you have state legislators crying. Or, I mean this literally, are really moved by the stories that come from our community. But then we interweave the data, which is the key element. And from what I've learned, there's a lot of advocacy happening at the state legislature, and there's a lot of storytelling. There's sometimes anger, there's sometimes, tear jerking, heart pulling. But if you don't come with the data, if you don't have a solid story on the data side of the equation, you're not going to get anywhere. Like the stories are going to have an impact, and they're going to move on to the next story and the next story and the next story, because one thing I wouldn't want to be is a legislator. They have to listen to every single complaint and pitch, and from every angle you can imagine. I can't even.
Fantastic, Matt. You've done a great job there giving us a crash course on how we might go and do this in our locale. But here I'm standing on the dock. I'm ready to board. You can cast us off and maybe tell us a story about the most exciting success of these efforts at the state level.
Oh, that's not easy. I mean, there's a bunch of them. In Washington at UW, we funded Chet Merritt's work that led to the preclinical or clinical data, but preclinical trial data for Onward, for transcutaneous stimulation. In Minnesota, we funded a bunch of things in a wide range of applications. The East End trial, epidural stimulation, which was in my mind, a pretty disruptive study to the field in terms of the way the group approached epidural stimulation, looking at all the past studies. The Mayo Clinic also in their neuromodulation studies, the CellTop mesenchymal stem cell Mohammed Biden clinical trial in Ohio. There's a fair amount of, some of Jerry Silver's work, Dennis Bourbeau's work, biomedical engineering, a lot of that at Case Western, Phil Popovich and Dana McTeague and Jaron Yora Fisher with some of the gut biome stuff. But I think, I would say one of the big ones early on was probably the East End trial, in the sense that, one, it was a significant disruption to how epidural stimulation was being studied. This idea of doing it without the pre-rehab, without the post-rehab, to find out what happens right away, what happens, and can we collect in a very shrewd way, can we collect a lot of data by giving people that iPod to go home with and play around with their stimulation parameters in a locked in, strict. Some people have a misperception that you've opened up the stimulator to let people do whatever they want. It's locked in, and you keep refining as you keep doing it. But the other significant piece was what they were fabulous at doing, and part of it is being here in Minnesota, is they got a commitment of 100 devices from Abbott in kind. That's $4.5 million, probably. I mean, maybe less now. I mean, I can't remember what they were quoted, but I mean, it's millions of dollars worth of devices that are leveraged. And of course, we use that a lot to talk to legislators because that's another piece of the argument, which I didn't mention. One piece of data is the ROI, what comes back to a state. And in that case, that's been a huge win because we have data to show. Somebody got a pilot grant, or we have programmatic grants that we try to implement in each state, a pilot, like a seed grant, a translational grant, and then a clinical grant. And we encourage the programs to think of them as programmatic. If somebody gets a seed grant and they do a proof of concept study and it works, then let's take it to the next one and fund them the next round for a translational grant. If that works, we want to entice them to move to human beings. Let's move this along and not, it not jumping it. If it needs iterative structure, then for sure. But otherwise, let's move it along. So that would be a good example, like the East End trial, of one where I think it was impactful to the field. Now it's upwards of 25 people who've been implanted and continue to be followed. And now it has tributaries. Like if there's a sexual function arm, and there's another arm, an optimization arm, there's a rehab arm. So it's really moved, I think, things along with an initial small grant, kind of a novel idea, which is really what we wanted. We wanted some free ideas to enter this space that you wouldn't be able to get from NIH or DOD or Nielsen.
So for one of our listeners who's maybe hasn't been tracking this space, they're hearing this now and they're thinking, oh my goodness, how do I make this happen in my state? What's your advice?
Call me. That's my advice. Call me because not even necessarily that we, it's not like we want to own it, but we've gotten pretty good at it, and we also know where the potholes are and the pitfalls. Without being too inflammatory, there's two places of opposition that we've had in almost every state. One of them is from the disability community itself, because there are people who hear what we're doing, who read our mission and say, hey, I don't need to be fixed. I don't need to be cured. The disability model philosophically is opposed to that. The idea is that the world needs to change around me. I don't need to change. So that's been a that was a surprise to me at first, but now I understand it. And we know how to talk about it. We know how we've built bridges with some of those folks once they understand. The other ones that are more difficult are the institutions themselves. Our biggest opponents are big universities, because they don't like the idea that you're carving out research dollars that they don't necessarily control. They're not crazy about people with lived experience, lay people voicing priorities to research. They would rather just get a blank check and say, we'll take care of it. We got it. We're experts at this. And and there are others. I mean, there are other challenges inherent to this. I mean, even just at the legislature, it is a cannibalistic, bloody, brutal, bone-crushing environment when it gets to budget crunch time and the end of session. People slit your throat to get their bill passed, and so there's a lot of different things that I think we can offer. As well as community folk. We have a lot, we have a big network, a growing network of people with spinal cord injuries that are calling, emailing legislators, kind of know how to do it now. So I would recommend they call us. But also understand we are moving away from our state work and heading to Congress. This was decided about a year ago. We paused a minute because things are changing at the federal level very soon. But our new perspective is that we also think there's going to be a lot of disruption and maybe a little bit of chaos starting next year. And maybe that's all the more reason to exploit that chaos and see what we can get done. So that's our thinking right now.
Matthew, any last minute, upcoming projects, exciting things in the works that you think our listeners would be should be looking out for?
Yeah, well, let me add, when I said we're going to Congress, we're in the process right now of kind of confirming our policy directives, like our, what our ask is going to be. And so for any of you listening, we'd love to hear from you. So you could please email me. We have a we may be crafting a survey, or we might just be collecting this information, because we intend really to focus on two areas, which is NIH and FDA. And we have some ideas about what we want to do, but we would love to hear from you if you have thoughts or ideas. As to some of the exciting things, yeah, we have a bunch of things going on that you might not know about if you look at our website. And it kind of falls in this bucket of work groups or think tanks. One of them is a translational working group. And anybody who got our recent newsletter or email knows that we are proposing a kind of crazy alternative to the current system. You could go check that out and also give us some feedback, what you think. That's been a years-long process with a group of scientists and clinicians and SEI folk. We also have a neuromodulation working group that's finalizing a paper right now, with Asia members, actually, working on that paper, which was a survey to try to get at what do people in the field doing this work think are the tools of measure and ways to profile your patients that are optimal? And are you doing it? And is it feasible to do? It's a pretty simple survey, but it was lengthy, and we're soon to be publishing the results of that. And now moving towards working with the Open Data Common folks to build the first kind of beta version of a spinal cord stimulation open data set on the SCI ODC. So for those of you who know, preclinical SCI ODC currently exists like that. We propose that we think the field would benefit, and we think our community would benefit from creating and open data commons where you can send data from your human studies in spinal cord stimulation, both transcutaneous and epidural. And lastly, we have a couple other projects. One, which just now is finally beginning, we proposed to a group of researchers in the company NerveGen that we do a combinatorial study in chronic injury in pigs, combining the NerveGen peptide NBG291 with epidural stimulation and see if there's a complementary effect between the two. Also working on a project with Jen Doolin at Texas A&M, where we proposed to Jen, and we're so happy that she said yes, to do a 15-year retrospective analysis of all the funding in spinal cord injury. We have completed NIH and DoD and VA, and that will be getting ready for publication. And that's got a bunch of SEI folk working on that project as well. Kind of the questions that our community wants to ask of the prioritization of money. And then we're proposing potentially another combinatorial study, which I'll keep under wraps, because it's not formed yet. And I think it's going to be very interesting. We're very, very interested in trying to propose and promote combinatorial studies that are translational and as best possible human study. We'd like to move things forward and see what complementary things can happen, understanding that, what might be sort of a common sense. Oh, well, if you put these two things together, they're going to work fabulously, knowing that that's not how science works. Not, it's a lot of things that are more far more complex than you might think on the surface, but that's why they need to be studied. So, I think that covers most of it. I mean, we got more stuff. We have a lot of stuff going on.
Well, Matt, thank you so much for coming, extending the olive leaf, just opening the chest to the listeners here and the invitation for us to reach out, both with some specific maybe policy directive advice for your step to Congress, but also in general. And I think for a lot of our listeners, they might not have thought of this state-level funding. And since you've paved the path, we're just so grateful that you'd be open to have those conversations.
Well, thanks. And I do have to give credit to those folks who did it. All our achievements are on the shoulders of others. So I'm grateful to that group back in the 90s who did what they did and sharing some of that information with me so we could continue that work and grow it, evolve it. But thank you.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCI Science Perspectives, brought to you by the American Spinal Injury Association. The topic discussed in this episode was recommended to us by our outreach committee. The podcast is made possible by the leadership of Dr. Suzanne Groh, your producer hosts, David McMillan, Freya Kalig, and Marla Petrella, our editor and production assistant, Abby Fox, and Asia's front office. If you have any comments, questions, or concerns, please contact us at sciperspectivespodcast@gmail.com.